Hi, I'm Jen White, and this is the 1A Podcast. It's the first week back for the Supreme Court, and as the justices prepare to take on major cases, including gun control and a challenge to Roe v. Wade, we're looking ahead to another case that could be on the docket later this term. It's called Brackeen v. Holland. It's about the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA. That's a federal law that's been around since the late 70s and is designed to preserve Native American families and culture. It's been challenged more times than the Affordable Care Act. So what's different about this particular case, and what happens if the Supreme Court strikes ICWA down? Joining us now is Rebecca Nagel. She's the host of the podcast This Land from Crooked Media. Season 2 is all about the Indian Child Welfare Act. Rebecca is also a citizen of Cherokee Nation. Rebecca, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to start by playing a clip from a conversation we had earlier this year about Native boarding schools. Here's Brian Newland. He's the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs at the Department of the Interior. He's also a citizen of the Bay Mills Indian community.
There hasn't been an Indian person in the United States whose life wasn't shaped by the boarding school era somehow or some way. It has been every bit as defining of the relationship between Indian people and the United States as the loss or the theft of our lands. And so this is the first time the United States federal government has ever engaged in a comprehensive review. Some of the first things we're going to try to identify and secure are the records that the Department of the Interior has scattered around different sites around the country of who was actually enrolled at these schools, who made it home, and who died.
Now, Rebecca, the legacy of the boarding school era played a major role in the creation of the Indian Child Welfare Act. Tell us about the history leading up to ICWA.
Absolutely. And so what we see when we look at history is that for generations, Native children have been used as the tip of the spear in the project of genocide and assimilation. And you can draw a straight line from the boarding school era to the Indian Adoption Project in the 50s and 60s to what is happening today with the current attack on ICWA. And so prior to the passage of ICWA in 1978, an estimated 25% to 35% of all Native children had been removed from their families and tribes by the government. Some of this was through a program at the BIA called the Indian Adoption Project, where the BIA actually gave money to organizations for to adopt Native children into white homes. And then the other big thing that was happening is that there was a lot of racism within state child welfare agencies, you know, and they would see a Native child being raised by an aunt or a grandma and call that childhood abandonment because that child wasn't being raised by their biological parents. And so ICWA was created in 1978, and I really think of it as a set of guardrails that protects a Native child when that child enters either the foster care system and the child welfare system or the private adoption system. And it really strengthens protections for the family in those cases, for the tribe, and for that child, with the goal of keeping Native kids in Native homes.
Now, as we said, season two of This Land focuses on Brackeen versus Holland, and that's the latest challenge to ICWA. We'll get into the details of the case in a bit, but first, let's talk about your reporting this season. Why did you decide to focus on the Indian Child Welfare Act?
Well, for a couple reasons. One is that these lawsuits, the series of lawsuits that have happened in the past decade, represent an existential threat to the legal structure defending Indigenous rights. And I'm sure we'll get into this more, but if the plaintiffs in this case prevail, it could set a really, really dangerous precedent that could topple the rest of federal Indian law. So literally the stakes could not be higher. And then as a journalist, these cases have not been covered accurately. They haven't been covered in a factual way. And so I think that it's I really wanted to create a body of well-researched, well-documented work that helped set the record straight as this case goes to the Supreme Court. You know, often these cases are talked about as, you know, ICWA ripped this child away from the only loving home that they had ever known. We dug deep into this case, went through thousands of pages of court documents, and that's not actually what happened. And then I think there's the bigger issue is that when you look at, you know, if these cases were just being brought by aggrieved foster parents, there is no way they would be heard by the Supreme Court. But they're being brought by some of the most, by state attorney generals. There's an entire funding network behind these cases and corporate law firms. And that's why they've gotten to this level. And no one else really investigated, you know, why are all of these folks so interested in a decades-old law about adoption of Native children? It's very odd. And so I felt like it warranted more reporting and investigation that we've seen so far.
So what is it about this decision on ICWA, potentially by the Supreme Court, that could lead to this cascading effect for other Native American protections in the country?
So the Indian Child Welfare Act only applies to children who are either enrolled in a tribe, in a federally recognized tribe, or eligible for enrollment. And so it's not about race. It's about that child's unique political status as a citizen of a sovereign indigenous nation and that indigenous nation's relationship to the U.S. federal government that's been established through treaties. And all of federal Indian law flows from that logic. So, you know, as a citizen of Cherokee Nation, I can go to a hospital here in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, that if you're not a citizen, they could actually turn you away. I can carry eagle feathers legally and non-Native people can't. So there are all of these laws that treat tribes and tribal citizens differently, quote unquote, than other groups of people. And that's not a race-based classification. It's a political classification. And so the plaintiffs, the non-Native foster parents in this case, say that ICWA discriminated against them because it gave Native families, in which most cases were actually the relatives of these children, gave Native families preference over them. And that's racial discrimination. Well, if ICWA discriminates based on race, what about, you know, my tribe's right to operate a casino where a non-Native casino developer can? Why do we have hunting and fishing rights? What other quote-unquote racial group in the U.S. has those rights? So the legal arguments that they're making go against centuries of law, really dating back to before the U.S. was even a country, where indigenous nations were recognized as sovereign nations through treaties with the United States. And this could drastically undermine that in a way that has very broad implications.
We'll be back with more in just a moment. And remember, to have your questions answered on future topics or to just let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Wyzant, a one-to-one tutoring alternative to online classes where you can learn face-to-face online. Get help with tackling new subjects and career skills, or just catching up. Wyzant lists thousands of personal instructors in over 300 subjects, available for live, individualized lessons with their online learning platform. Head to wyzant.com to find your perfect instructor. Love it, or your first hour is free. Because at Wyzant, we take learning personally.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to the conversation. Well, let's listen to a clip from season 2 of This Land. This is your interview with Sandy Whitehawk, a Lakota woman who grew up on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota in the 1950s. She was taken away from her family and her tribe and adopted by a white family in a small rural community.
We had a drill in our house that if a car drove up the driveway, we knew that it would be somebody from the government or a social worker or something.
But one day, Sandy wasn't fast enough.
I remember one of my uncles saying that he remembers the day that the social worker came and got me, drove into the driveway, and I was toddling around, and they were all sitting around the house, as far as I know. That's how it was told to me. And she just simply got out of the car, scooped me up, and put me in the car.
Her relatives watched the whole thing.
Could you imagine what that would have been like? Could you imagine that you knew not to move and not to do anything and not to grab me and fight for me? Because they would have been put in jail and I would have still been taken.
Now, Rebecca, Sandy's story depicts the pre-ICWA reality. Can you give us a little more context about what happened?
Yeah, so Sandy Whitehawk is a really important voice and national advocate for adoptees and for Indian child welfare. And what happened to her happened to a lot of people in her generation, that, you know, she was a toddler playing outside her house, and one day a social worker literally just drove up and scooped her up and took her away. And that happened to a lot of Native children in the 50s and 60s. And it's still happening. You know, Native children are still really overrepresented in our child welfare and foster care systems. There's huge racial disproportionalities in those systems still. So just one example, in the state of Minnesota, Native kids have a 1 in 3 chance of entering foster care before they turn 18. And Native infants have a 1 in 10 chance of entering foster care before their first birthday. Nationally, white babies have a 1 in 100 chance. And, you know, people might think, oh, well, that's just because, you know, there's bigger problems within the Native community. But when you look at why children are being removed, the majority of those cases have nothing to do with abuse. It's this more nebulous category of neglect. And a lot of time, poverty, especially extreme poverty, looks like neglect. And so, you know, we're taking families, children away because they're experiencing homelessness or having trouble with transportation. So instead of giving that family support so that they can provide for that family, we'll give strangers money to take that child and put that child in foster care.
Rebecca, how much has actually changed under the law since 1978?
That's a really good question. So one thing with ICWA is that there's actually not national data, whether or not the federal government is going to collect national data on ICWA compliance is actually part of an ongoing lawsuit right now. But what we see where there is good ICWA compliance, so we have pockets of data, is that kids have better outcomes. So things like if we collected data from Hennepin County, and kids whose cases fell under ICWA were actually less likely to age out of the foster care system. So those are kids that have been in foster care until they turn 18. And then when they become, you know, the age of majority, they're kind of just kicked out on their own. And the other thing that happens with Native kids whose cases fall under ICWA, they're more likely to be adopted or to be in the care of a relative, which child welfare research has actually found is what's best, not just for Native kids, but for all children in the child welfare system. And so what we see with ICWA where there is compliance is these better outcomes. But unfortunately, you know, there are a lot of family court judges, there are a lot of child welfare workers and social workers, and a lot of private adoption attorneys who don't understand the law or who don't follow the law. And often in these cases, you know, where there's this story of, okay, this child has been with this family for a period of time and now they're going to be moved, you can look and find a moment where ICWA wasn't followed, and then people try and run out that clock and then use that clock as an excuse to not follow the law later on.
I want to bring one more voice into the conversation. Joining us now is Neosha Romer. She's an assistant professor at the University of Idaho College of Law, specializing in family and Native American law. Professor Romer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jen.
So can you first just explain how ICWA is supposed to work? How people, if they're in alignment with the law, what it looks like?
Sure. So I think the thing that's very important to iterate here is that in any child welfare proceeding, any adoption case, one of the very first questions that any agency, including state or private agency, should be asking and is required to ask under federal law is this an Indian child? Because ICWA follows the child themselves. So if that child is eligible for enrollment in a federal Indian tribe, or if they're already enrolled, if they're already born, ICWA applies. And so ICWA is supposed to be applied at the very outset of any type of child welfare proceeding, any type of adoption proceeding, anything that can result in foster care or any sort of interruption or disruption of a parent's right or termination of a parent's right.
And so in asking that question, if the answer is yes, this child is an Indian child, what does that trigger?
So that question itself triggers ICWA automatically. And so what that looks like is, let's say we have a child and we know that the child's parent, for example, is a member of an Indian tribe. The state or the private agency should begin notifying that child's tribe, letting them know that, and now I'll stick with the foster care scenario. But in foster care situations, for example, the state has a responsibility to contact that child's tribe and let them know that there is an adjudication regarding that child. And at that point, the tribe will then acknowledge, yes, this child is a member here, or it could be a member. And what that means is ICWA applies. But I think it's very, very important to also reiterate that any proceedings that are happening in any case prior to that acknowledgement from the tribe, it's always best practice to apply ICWA early to make sure that the type of scenario that Rebecca mentioned, or that private adoptive parent whose clip you played or whose message you played mentioned, if it's not applied early, that's when we start to run into these situations of court battles that are prolonged even past the child themselves being adopted.
We're talking about the Indian Child Welfare Act. A reminder that you can join future conversations. Download our 1A Vox Pop app and leave us a voicemail. We'll be back with more after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BASF. North American Chairman and CEO Michael Hines shares why they're taking on the challenge of improving the batteries in electric cars.
We are one of the major suppliers of the main ingredients that you would find in a car manufacturer's battery. And as the automotive industry is shifting more towards electromobility, we also have a responsibility through science to come up with some of these solutions.
To learn more about BASF's battery material innovations, go to BASF.com.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to our conversation about the Indian Child Welfare Act. Now, Rebecca, the last time the Indian Child Welfare Act appeared before the Supreme Court was in 2013. The case was called Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl. What was this case about and how did the court rule?
So the story of that case is that there was a Native child, a Cherokee child, that was adopted by a couple in South Carolina. I shouldn't say she wasn't adopted by them. Adoption proceedings had stopped and they were actually stalled when the courts found that ICWA hadn't been followed. But that child was moved to South Carolina without the knowledge of her tribe and also without the knowledge or consent of her father. The actual custody proceedings went all the way to the Supreme Court. And I would say what happened is that there was pretty terrible media coverage that didn't cover the facts of the underlying custody case accurately and mostly left out the broader implications for federal Indian law. And a really interesting thing happened, in the state courts. The case was mostly, about custody and the best interest of the child and these debates over, how ICWA should be applied. And then when the case went to the Supreme Court, it became about a whole lot more. And that equal protection argument we talked about before showed up for the first time in the case. And it was brought, one of the people who brought it was a lawyer named Paul Clement. So he argued that ICWA was racial discrimination and therefore it was unconstitutional. And the really interesting thing about Paul Clement making that argument in an ICWA case is that at the same time, he was making the exact same argument on behalf of a non-native casino developer who was angry that a tribe could build a casino where he could not. And he was trying to prevent that from happening. And so Mr. Clement literally took that argument that he had already been making on behalf of the gaming industry to attack tribal gaming and just imported it into the ICWA context. The Supreme Court did not declare ICWA unconstitutional. They came up with this very, very, very narrow ruling that I think, decreases protections for Native fathers. But what it did was, it was basically the blood in the water moment, because the court in some of its language showed that it was at least sympathetic to some of Clement's arguments about how ICWA is based on race and biology. And after Baby Girl is when we saw this avalanche of cases. So before Baby Girl, the constitutionality of ICWA was rarely challenged. And since then, it's been challenged more times since the Affordable Care Act.
Well, Professor Romer, I want to get into the details of Bracking versus Holland. This is the case that could be taken up this term by the Supreme Court. The case is about constitutionality, whether it's constitutional for family members, tribal members, or other Native families to get priority when Native children are up for adoption. Can you lay out the arguments in this case, both for the plaintiffs and the defendants?
Sure. So the primary argument for the plaintiff, for the states, and for the adoptive couples in this case, is that ICWA, which is a federal law, commandeers state law. Without getting too deep into the legal weeds of this, child welfare traditionally is a matter of state law. Each state has its own child welfare code, and has its own adoption code as well. So these matters are typically state law matters. But in 1978, as Rebecca has pointed out, Congress enacted ICWA because of its special political relationship with tribes and tribal citizens. So in doing so, Congress passed this law that does, to some extent, regulate. It speaks to Indian affairs and Congress's role to regulate Indian affairs. So the plaintiffs are arguing that ICWA commandeers state law inappropriately. And so that's the big question here, is whether Congress can legislate these types of laws that pertain to American Indian peoples if they might conflict with state laws. Now, on the, I suppose on the defendant side, which, and by defendants, we're talking tribes, we're talking the federal government, who I should mention, regardless of party, this is a bipartisan effort, supports ICWA. But on that side of things, the argument is that Congress has not commandeered state law in passing ICWA, because Congress does have the ability to pass laws affecting Native Americans and that speak to Indian affairs. So that is the tension there. It's between this idea of well, Congress can't commandeer state law, and the other side being there is no commandeering of state law because Congress has every right, the absolute constitutional authority, to pass laws regulating Indian affairs.
Well, back in April, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on Bracking versus Holland, and the court has jurisdiction over Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas. Rebecca, here's some of your reporting on the courtroom scene from episode 7 of the podcast.
Mark, can I get a quick comment?
I really don't want us to talk. I'm sorry.
Okay. Do you mind telling me why?
Matt's handling all of our communications for the team.
Matt is Matthew McGill from Gibson Dunn, the plaintiff's other lawyer. When it was McGill's turn to speak, he told the same story he's been telling about how the Indian Child Welfare Act is tearing families apart.
Thank you, Chief Judge Owen, and may it please the court, Matthew McGill for the individual plaintiffs. My clients opened their hearts and their homes to a child in need and embraced that child as a part of their family. They are here because the Indian Child Welfare Act's placement preferences turned their lives and their families upside down, solely because the child they took in is an Indian child, and they are not and cannot be, because of their race, Indian families.
Rebecca, how did the court decide?
That's a really good question and a complicated one to answer. Basically, I think the easiest way to say it is that they didn't. They were split 8-8 on key issues of not just ICWA, but the constitutionality of federal Indian law. So there wasn't really what we would call like a controlling majority opinion. There were some parts of the law that a majority said were constitutional. There were some other very narrow parts of the law that a majority said were unconstitutional. But for the most part, they couldn't make up their minds. And I think that that shows I think just how much momentum this case has. I think a really important thing to note is that in that avalanche of cases that have come since Baby Girl, they all went absolutely nowhere. You know, federal and state courts dismissed them, a lot of them just based on pure standing issues. They didn't get a lot of traction. But by really taking this case first to a very, very conservative judge, a judge that even the Wall Street Journal has accused of going too far in his conservative opinions in the district court, and then taking it to one of the more conservative courts in the U.S. appeals court, you know, this case has a lot of momentum and is really set up to be heard by the Supreme Court. But I think, you know, that shows, I think, how fragile federal Indian law is when it comes to federal courts, that an appeals court would be split almost 50-50 on key issues of the fundamental constitutionality of a 40-year-old law like ICWA.
Well, Professor Romer, one of the constitutionality questions around the Indian Child Welfare Act is related to equal protection rights. Can you explain what that is and how it's a part of this case?
Sure. So equal protection is this concept that all laws must be applied equally to all people. So this comes from the 14th Amendment. This particular claim comes from the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. And under equal protection, laws are meant to be applied equally, but if there are certain classifications within a law, the state may pass the law, but one of the issues that brings up is, you know, to what extent is that law creating disparate impact? And I should tell you that our current jurisprudence on equal protection actually comes from things like affirmative action, you know, looking at concepts of, you know, how race-based laws are passed, gender-based laws, those types of things. And actually, I misspoke. I believe what we're talking about is actually the Fifth Amendment, not the 14th Amendment. But both of those constitutional provisions speak to equal protection, one at the federal level and the other at the state level. So in terms of ICWA, as Rebecca has already mentioned, American Indians and what we're talking about with ICWA in terms of Indian children, this is not a race-based statute. This is actually based on the political status of Indian children. as members or eligible members of federal Indian tribes with whom Congress has a special political relationship with. So that is the reason that the equal protection arguments have not prevailed this far, is because American Indians, in terms of these types of laws that Congress has the authority to pass, are not considered racial-based or race-based classifications under the law. And that actually comes from cases in the 1970s that talk about American Indians and laws that protect or govern or regulate Indian affairs are not race-based classifications.
Professor Romer, I want to turn to the legal road ahead. When will we know for sure if the Supreme Court will take up Bracken versus Holland?
Jen, I am not entirely sure about the timeline. My understanding is that the parties are currently in the briefing stage. But if I may, I would just add, Rebecca mentioned Louisiana.
In just about 30 seconds here.
Okay. Rebecca mentioned Louisiana. And I would say that, I would just add to that, that during the course of this case, Louisiana actually passed its own state ICWA law. And we see 12 states now have their own form of ICWA, which means even if ICWA is declared unconstitutional, it will still be good law in those 12 states. And we see movement from child welfare advocates and states because ICWA is best child welfare practice.
And Rebecca, briefly, what happens if the court doesn't take up the case?
I think there is a good argument that the plaintiffs in this case don't have standing. And so we'll see, which means they don't, you know, have the standing to bring the case. And so we'll see in the briefing if the case may be dismissed on those grounds.
That's Rebecca Nagel. She's the host of the podcast This Land from Crooked Media, and she's a citizen of Cherokee Nation. Also with us, Neosha Romer, an assistant professor at the University of Idaho College of Law. Rebecca, Professor Romer, thanks for speaking with us. Today's producers were Catherine Fink and Paige Osborne. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.